Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The night they drove old Dixie down, and the bells were ringing. The night they drove old Dixie down, and all the people were singing. They went na la 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 la.
A band so important that they could just call themselves The Band. The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down is one of the great enduring songs of the late 60s. It was written by Robbie Robertson, who wrote most of the band's hits and has written a lot of music over the past 50 years in a wide variety of styles. I'm John Schaefer. Welcome to a special edition of the Soundcheck podcast from newsounds.org and the studios of WNYC in New York. Now, as you may know, this series usually focuses on live in-studio performances, but we'll make an exception for Robbie Robertson today for four good reasons. First of all, Robbie, it's good to have you back in our studio.
Well, thank you.
There is so much happening. There's the Irishman, the Martin Scorsese movie that you've scored. There's the new album, Cinematic. There's the documentary called Once We're Brothers. And there's the 50th anniversary of the album called The Band. And with so many things going on, it seems like there's a surprising number of connections between these four different projects that are all happening now.
It's just the way things evolved. It certainly wasn't a plan, or I would have been smart enough to spread things out a little bit more. But anyway, it turned out that I'm just actually, through this record, Cinematic, I'm able to rejoice in all of these projects because it all circles back to that. And the songs on this record are very reflective of The Irishman, of Once We're Brothers, of the 50th anniversary of the band album, all of these things. And it even steps slightly into Volume 2 of my memoir that I'm writing now, too. So I just opened up my arms and said, come on in.
Well, the album includes a song called I Hear You Paint Houses, which is almost the title of the book that The Irishman is based on. It's I Heard You Paint Houses in the book. So this is clearly something that, you know, has grown up along with the Scorsese movie. It features Van Morrison, an old friend of yours. Where did this come in the kind of the dual process of scoring the film and making a standalone album?
Yeah, in trying to discover the music for this movie, what this would take, what could work in this thing, and of course Marty, you know, his only instructions are as long as it doesn't sound like movie music. So, okay, you're like, that eliminates a lot. But while I was working on the music for the movie, this phrase that I heard you paint houses, it just stayed with me, and it had nothing to do with writing a song that should go in the movie, because the movie takes place over other decades, and having like a new song come up in the movie, that was, you know, I didn't want that to happen. But I couldn't help but write this song because I was working on the music for it, and it just came out. And I had just finished the song, and Van Morrison was in town, and we were catching up, and he said, you know, what are you working on? And so I played him this song, kind of a writer's version of this song, and he said, oh man, I like that. And I said, do you want to sing on it? And he said, yes. So we ended up doing this together, and that is just a complete joy for me, you know, being able to do something with my old buddy Van.
I hear you paint houses. You're a gun for hire. I hear you paint houses down
the emperor has no clothes.
I hear you paint houses. You are gone for hire. I hear you paint houses right down to the wire.
Now, the album is called Cinematic, but it's spelled with an S instead of a C. So it's cinematic music. Some of it is literally cinematic, but some of it is also about sin. Crime in I Hear You Paint Houses and in Shanghai Blues. War comes up a lot, several times in these songs. So is that title a kind of a portmanteau word that you put together to acknowledge the two different streams coming into this record?
Well, I think I was probably leaning in a direction of noir, you know, because there is a darkness in here. And because I'm working with Martin Scorsese and...
The master of the dark arts.
There you go. And we joked even at one point that I was writing Peckinpah rock, you know, and you know that there was a lot of violence in these songs, in the subject matter, in these characters, and it just came natural because of what I was working on, and I thought if I don't write in acknowledging that part of life and that part of what's going on in the world and what was going on in the world, I'm not being honest. And the idea of going into this place of shadiness, it just felt really good.
Did you feel like you were writing your own little movie or series of short films when you were writing these songs? I mean, you mentioned characters. There are certainly stories unfolding, as there always have been in your songs.
Well, that's it. I've always thought of my songs as little movies. So I'm just carrying on my own tradition, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, the song called Once We're Brothers, also the title of the documentary, mentions war.
We lost the connection after the war.
I was referring to what we were living in. This is a reflection of the band. When things in the band started to separate was after the Vietnam War, and I had written this song about the Civil War, and all of these elements just came up in the song when I was writing it. I don't know why, but it was all I could think of at the time.
There's a moment in the film called Once We're Brothers where you talk a little bit about this song. Let's hear what that sounds like.
When I stumbled onto this song, Once We're Brothers, it really did, for me, zero in on the band.
Once we're brothers, brothers no more. We lost the connection after the war.
I don't know of any other group of musicians with a story equivalent to the story of the band. And it was a beautiful thing. It was so beautiful it went up in flames.
Brothers no more.
So, Robbie, the thing that strikes me there is your use of the word stumbled. You stumbled upon this song. Is that how the songwriting process works for you?
Yeah. You take something out of the air that didn't exist, and it starts to form. It starts to become something. And it is a bit of a roll of the dice, too. You know, you sit down and you think, this is my job. I need to write a song. And you sit down, and sometimes something comes. And a lot of times, what you think you're doing turns out, it reveals itself to go in a different direction altogether. Now, that discovery process is part of really what makes me tick. Mm. That thing that can sneak up on you and surprise you, and you go somewhere, and that was the least of what you thought and everything, that's very exciting.
Does that happen to you with art as well, the cover art? All of the artwork for Cinematic is yours.
Yes, and a lot of times I sit down and I draw a couple of lines or I paint a couple of lines and I think, I don't even know what I'm doing here. And then, oh, wait a minute, that looks like it's going somewhere. And then I make a mistake and that works. And that changes everything. So, you know, that is part of the creative process.
But now working with Martin Scorsese, you know, it's not a blank canvas. There is a story that you've been handed. And sometimes Marty will give you directions, and maybe sometimes he kind of leaves you to your own devices. But even "Don't Give Me Something That Sounds Like Film Music" is a direction. So how different, if at all, is that part of your creative process?
You know, it over the years working with Marty, every movie has been a different program, a different kind of chore. And that's what's exciting about it. That's part of why it works for me. Mm-hmm. That if we were just kind of in our formula, I don't know. And Marty knows, I was never someone who said, you know what, I want to score movies. I want to do incidental music. You know, I never wanted to do anything incidental. Working with him, it sure ain't incidental. It's so powerful. And he has said many times, there's no difference between the picture and the music. It's the same thing. And when they work together, that equals where this needs to go. So, on The Irishman, this was trying to figure out something, because it takes place over many, many decades. And finding a music that didn't sound like, oh, that sounds like it's from the 60s. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's got kind of a 90s vibe to it. I had to find something that could live anytime, anywhere. And so that was a big challenge. And I'm really proud of the way the music works in this movie.
Well, and of course, you're a guitarist, and the electric guitar now has a history that encompasses those long decades that the movie covers. And that kind of distinctive twangy sound that you've developed over the course of your long career seems to me like it would work, you know, for both the 30-year-old Robert De Niro character and the 75-year-old character.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the direction I didn't go in. You know, part of the chore, too, is to avoid the obvious and embrace the unexpected.
On the album Cinematic, the track Remembrance does dual duty, right? It's in the score and it's on the album as a standalone piece.
Yes, it's at the end of the movie for the end credits.
There we do get to hear that distinctive guitar sound.
Yes.
But much of the process, I guess, of writing these songs, some of the process at least, revolved you looking back, as we were talking about before with Once We're Brothers, looking back at the band, and it just happens to be the 50th anniversary of that album, the second album, called simply The Band.
Up on Cripple Creek, she sends me if I spring a leak.
That is an opportunity to revisit something that you did literally half a century ago. What was that like for you?
Well, this is probably the center of the brotherhood of the band. This is when we were locked in, and it allowed me to write songs that I knew these guys could do, and it would be different than anybody else in the world.
And that nag to win came around the track. Sure enough, we had won.
Up on Cripple Creek, and she sends me if I spring a leak. And she means me, I don't have the speed. She defends me, a drunkard's dream if I ever did see one.
Well, now, of course, you were the band, and you guys and Bob Dylan had done the Basement Tapes. I mean, you were the kings of the alternate take or the undiscovered outtake. And, you know, this 50th anniversary version of the album, The Band, is full of alternate things and recordings we haven't heard before, and a kind of amazing sort of bonus is the recording of Woodstock, which has never been officially released before.
We didn't participate in the Woodstock film, because when we played at Woodstock, it was only like our second gig as the band.
Uh-huh.
And there's 500,000 people out there. So our manager, Albert Grossman, said to them, listen, for everybody, you have cameramen running around the stage and filming them with a camera in their face and everything. You can't do that with these guys. You can't. You have to film it from way back. That's all you can do. I don't want to see any cameras. And he was right about that, because, you know, we were going to be doing something that was almost against the grain of what this festival was, because I've said this before, that when we went out there to play, people were jumping up and down and muddy and crazy and wanting to rock their brains out. And when we went out and started to play, it was equivalent to hymns. It was like somebody came out there and started playing hymns over this audience.
I pulled in the Nazareth. I was feeling about half past dead. I just need to find some place where I can lay my head.
And the jumping and, you know, rocking stopped, and everybody went into a bit of a trance while we played. And then we were done. We packed up and left, and then they all started jumping and rocking again. But it was a different experience. Now we have this unreleased set that the band played at Woodstock. This was 1969. The concert and the album was 1969. So we decided to include this in the package. And the outtakes, there's outtakes that I didn't even remember existed until I heard them. There's a version of Rag Mama Rag that is completely different, and I love it.
Rag, mama, rag.
speaking with Robbie Robertson about his many current projects, 50th anniversary of The Band, which includes the Woodstock set, the new album Cinematic, the documentary Once We're Brothers, the Martin Scorsese movie called The Irishman. When did you meet Scorsese and start working with him?
Well, I first met him after he did Mean Streets. And then when I wanted to do The Last Waltz, I was trying to think of who could capture this. Who is the guy that's got the touch, the vision, the imagination, all of these things? And some reason, my instincts took me completely to Marty, and I asked him to do it. And there was, you know, it wasn't easy because he was shooting another movie at the time, but we figured it out. Mm-hmm. And we did something that is, you know, it will live on.
I see my life come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released.
Well, the misconception about The Last Waltz was that it was, you know, a goodbye. It was the final moment. But as we learn in the documentary, Once We're Brothers, that was not your intention with The Last Waltz.
That wasn't my dream. The Last Waltz was to bring the journey that we had been on so far, the band, to a conclusion and a musical celebration. And then everybody... Some of the guys, they wanted to do other projects and make solo albums and all these things. And I thought, that's good. That's healthy. But at this time, it was such a crazy period in the music world, in the movie world, of people, you know, the whole experimenting with drugs and everything had gone over the edge. Mm-hmm. And it affected the band. But we knew nothing about alcoholism and addiction. We just thought, you already had a beer. Why do you need another one?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We didn't get it, right? And so as these things, it really got in the way of the music. It got in the way of our live performances. And it got in the way of the brotherhood. And so that's why I said, let's do The Last Waltz. Everybody will take a breather, gather ourselves, and then we will come back and we will do something creatively. And as I say in the movie, everybody forgot to come back.
Hmm. Well, there was another album that the original band lineup made, I guess, that came out after The Last Waltz. And the other four guys actually did come back and tour as the band. You didn't. Why?
Well, the other guys, after a period of time, they said, we need to make a living. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they said, can we use the name The Band? And I said, absolutely. You know, I would never stand in the way of somebody, you know, making a living. So they said, do you want to come and play some gigs with us? And I said, no, I'm interested in the creative move and the road. I put the road behind me because in that period, whenever we went out on the road, things got very dark. Things, and there was a lot of characters out there that weren't good for the situation. And so I wanted to put that behind me. And as I say in The Last Waltz, you know, after we lost Jimi Hendrix and Janis and many, many other people that we loved and appreciated their talent so much, there was something to learn from that. And if we didn't take something of that into consideration, we were just being blind. So when they went out and played, I had a great fear of what might happen. And I very sadly, I was correct about that. Yeah. And we lost Richard Manuel, and then we lost Rick Danko, and then we lost Lee Von Helm. So I could sense something, and it didn't feel like it was meant to be for me.
Yeah.
So I passed on it.
Was that in your mind when you were writing some of these songs for Cinematic, some of the more retrospective ones?
You know, like I said, that was part of it, that we went through this era of this experimenting with drugs and everything, and it grew to a place that was harmful and dangerous, and it did interfere. Mm-hmm. It never interfered with the love that I felt for my brothers. And with Levon, you know, I hooked up with him when I was 16 years old, and he was like the big brother, and he showed me the ropes, and it was extraordinary what we experienced together over all those years. You couldn't write this. You couldn't make this up. This was beyond mythology, where, you know, we played at Jack Ruby's club. We played at Watkins Glen for 650,000 people. We had been there, seen it, done it, everything together, back to back.
Not bad for a dead-end kid, which is one of the songs on Cinematic, the song called Dead End Kid.
I stole a Bible from a hotel room. I can't pay the bill, and checkout time is noon. Someone double-crossed me, left me out to dry. Now all I can do is pray and hope an angel happens by. They said you'll never be nothing, you're just a dead-end kid. Probably end up in prison, or maybe down on the skids. No, you'll never be nothing.
And that too seems to come from the more autobiographical stream of songwriting. Was that your experience growing up as a at least partially First Nations kid in Canada in the 50s?
It was 100% part of it, because I was 13 years old. I was already playing guitar that I had learned on the Six Nation Indian Reserve where my mom was from. And I was told over and over again, don't set yourself up for a big disappointment. This is heartbreak. This doesn't happen for people like us. And that was on one side of the family. Then on the other side of the family, the Jewish side of my family, they were like, you know, people like us, 50-50, we end up in prison or we don't, you know. And so all of these obstacles seemed like they were roadblocks. But for me, I was on a mission and I couldn't feel that.
Some call it homeless. Some call it stranded. Some say it's like being lost. Others call it abandoned. Sleeping in the subways, hiding in the underground. My mama was looking for me, but I was nowhere to be found.
And all these years later, both sides of the family kind of inform you've got all these characters who, you know, are maybe 50-50. They end up in jail in these songs.
That's true.
And then, although it took a long time for it to become explicit in your music, in the 90s, you did that album called for Music for the Native Americans.
Yes.
Which, you know, was sort of, it seemed like that was you stating unequivocally, I'm proud of this part of my family heritage as well. During the period of the band, was it just a different period where that was not something you talked about or put out in front of people?
Well, I talked about it to my friends and my family. I just wasn't going out, you know, preaching about anything. Well, there was also a period when, you know, I was quite young, and the idea of telling people, because, you know, my friends would say, hey, I'm Irish, and somebody would say, I'm Italian. And they'd say, well, what are you? And I'd say, well, I'm half Mohawk and half Jewish. And it would be like, you know what? You should wait in the car because that doesn't equate at all. So it was like, oh my God, maybe I shouldn't bring this up too often. And also my mom told me when she went from the Indian Reserve and was sent to Toronto to live with her aunt, that the word was, be proud you're an Indian, but be careful who you tell.
This was the way of it. Let the story fires be lighted. Let our circle be strong and full of medicine. Hear me. This is my dream song that I'm singing for you. This is my power song that is taking me to the edge. This is rock medicine, the talking tree, the singing water. Listen, I am dancing underneath you.
Robertson and the Red Road Ensemble, the album called Music for the Native Americans, and that excerpt is called Twisted Hair. Robbie Robertson, my guest here in our new sound studio on this edition of the Soundcheck podcast. And Robbie, you said before you couldn't make this stuff up, you couldn't just write it, but it turns out you are writing it because Volume 2 of your memoir is the next big project.
Yeah, I'm in the midst of that, and now I have all of these things going on that I'm very grateful for, but at some point, again, I am going to go into that place of solitude and do what I need to do to write this in as good a way as I can.
Well, that time is not now, because right now, Robbie Robertson has his plate full. 50th anniversary of The Band. The 50th anniversary edition of that record includes their Woodstock performance, officially released for the first time. There's the documentary Once We're Brothers, the new film with Martin Scorsese called The Irishman, and of course, the new album called Cinematic. I don't know how you're juggling all of these balls in the air at the same time, Robbie, but thank you so much for coming in and talking about them with us today.
It was really fun. Thank you very much.
And that wraps up this somewhat unusual edition of the Soundcheck podcast. We will be back to live performances in our studio next time. Let me thank our technical director, as always, Irene Trudell, and producer Karen Havlick. And thank you for being with us. I'm John Schaefer. Keep up with all of our Soundcheck podcasts and everything else we're doing at New Sounds. It's all on our website at newsounds.org.